Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real life store stage. All the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Welcome to History Hack. If you didn't know by now, we are the revolution. That means we're sharp, witty, lots of fun, but it also means that we're essentially the peasants in Les Mis huddled round a table in the corner of the bar with no money. If you enjoy the show, please do support us. We have a Patreon account by which you can donate a small monthly sum in appreciation of what you're hearing. Alternatively, we have Ko-fi, in which you can just do a one-off donation as a thank you if you particularly enjoy a certain episode. Either way, we massively appreciate all of your support. Hope you enjoy the show.
Hello and welcome to a very special episode of History Hack. Since I've been doing this more regularly, there has been a lot of requests and pleading and begging and screaming and crying and then finally demands that there be a monthly naval episode. And eventually I said, all right, Alina, fine, I'll do it. No problem. At the moment, it's unnamed. I'm not very good at naming things, which is probably a good thing that my ex-wife actually named my children. Otherwise, they would be 1, 2, and 3. Or Scharnhorst and Eisenhower and Victoria and Louise. But I'm not here alone, as I'm on a bit of a cultural exchange. This morning I sat through and assisted with Jane Austen, of which I know absolutely nothing. And so I've brought along Beth Wyatt to educate her in naval history. Hi, Beth, how are you doing?
Hi, Chris. Yeah, doing well.
Who have we got today and what were you looking at?
Yeah, so our guest today is Alexander Rose, and Alex is a journalist and historian who has written the New York Times bestseller Washington Spies, the story of America's first spy ring, which AMC picked up and made Turn Washington Spies, as well as Empires of the Sky and Kings of the North. And he's here today to talk to us about his latest book, The Lion and the Fox, Two Rival Spies and the Secret Plot to Build a Confederate Navy. Hi, thanks for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me on.
This book is fantastic. We're urging people to buy it at the end as well. This was something that I hadn't really thought about in context of the American Civil War. Everyone tends to think about the land campaigns. But let's set the scene. Confederacy has risen. They've attacked Fort Sumter and started the Civil War. And obviously, the North holds the Navy. Why is this a big problem for the Confederacy?
The reason is the Union Navy, Lincoln's Navy, which was not powerful by any means. It was, you know, on an absolute basis. I mean, compared to the Royal Navy or the French Navy, it was like a gnat. It didn't really count. But it was a lot more powerful than the Confederate Navy, which at that time, at the beginning of the war, consisted of precisely one blue water ship. So really, there wasn't a lot to work with. The danger to the Confederacy is that first, they have no real industrial capacity. They don't have the ability to build ships, unlike the North. Second, the North is a major industrial power in and of itself, and it has the ability to rapidly acquire or build ships of its own. So that Navy, it's a bit of a pipsqueak, can rapidly grow. Now, the real danger to the South is that when that Navy, that Union Navy grows, it begins to impose or enforce, rather, the blockade of the entire southern coast, all the way from Virginia, all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. Now, since the South isn't really economically self-sufficient, it has to import and export in order to survive and in order to, grow, sort of improve its or strengthen its sinews for this war that has just begun. So that's the real danger here. It's the danger of not a sudden strike. It's more of a, like a snake's bite. It's more of a, like an anaconda effect. You're just going to be slowly strangled by the North. So the South has to break free of that grip. That's its main, its main responsibility or task here.
What kind of items are the South in need of that the blockade is stopping?
Well, pretty much everything. It ranges from, I mean, they weren't even printing their own Bibles. They had to import Bibles to distribute to their troops. That's how, you know, unself-sufficient they were. I mean, it was a kind of a backward rural society compared to the much more industrialized North. Now, it doesn't mean that, that it doesn't have any industry at all. It could build, say, a railway or locomotives. It could build a ship or two, it couldn't really expand past that. Now, this is a war that's breaking out has elements of a modern war in it. It has railways and, new types of weapons and all that kind of stuff. And it's going to be a long war. But the South does have one treasure. It has one big thing that nobody else has. And that is it has the world's largest supply of high grade cotton, raw cotton, picked in the fields by, a massive slave labor force and, exported to mostly to Britain. I mean, the vast majority of it to Britain, which is the world's greatest importer and exporter of textiles at the time. About 20% of the British economy or 20% of the people in Britain are indirectly or directly employed or dependent on the cotton industry. It's sort of one of those oft forgotten facts about 19th century Britain. And so the cotton from the South can be exported, and that will pay for all the stuff that the South needs in exchange. For instance, basic stuff like guns, munitions, ammunition, everything, artillery shells, everything comes in through the Atlantic. But that is currently being partly blocked by the Northern blockade of the South.
So in this story, who is Captain James Bullock and what is his mission?
Captain James Bullock was from Georgia. He was, from an old line Georgia family, kind of an affluent family, been over there for generations. They'd owned slaves. Bullock himself didn't. He had left to go to a boarding school in the North when he was about 12 or something. So he was never really in the South much. And he goes directly from school into the U.S. Navy, the old Navy of the time. And he's as an officer and he rises up the ranks, but it's a slow, it's a slow, greasy pole. And, he gains a lot of experience in doing things like, navigation of coasts. He learns how to construct and build ships, which is an extremely, extremely complicated process through, in the shipyards. And he eventually leaves the Navy, as many people did in the early 1850s, and he becomes a private mailboat captain. And he does the run from where he's based in New York, and he goes down to Cuba and back and forth and so on. And he makes a bit of money. He's called up at the beginning of the war, and he has to make a choice about whether he wants to, stay as he is in the North or whether he will join the nascent Confederate Navy. And he makes a choice for the South, even though, as he says, I don't have any property there. I don't have any interest there. It's just, I think it's like a romantic attachment to the good old Georgia kind of stuff. But he turns out he's a perfect recruit for the secret world the Confederate Secret Service. And that is, he's clean. The North doesn't know about him. He's not involved with any skullduggery or anything. But he is a fantastic recruit. And so he gets sent over to Liverpool, in England, obviously. And his job is to build, acquire, commission a secret Confederate fleet consisting of, blockade runners and commerce raiders and ironclad rams, in order to fit out the Confederate Navy, and that will the real point being to break that blockade and to destroy the U.S. Navy. So that's his job from day one, and he could just continues on it throughout the war.
Yeah, he has quite a fascinating career. I won't drop too many spoilers, but it almost brings Britain into the war. Palmerston, the Prime Minister, says that the Royal Navy and Great Britain are in a position to inflict a severe blow upon and to read a lesson to the United States, which will not soon be forgotten. So what kind of, I'm trying not to use, I'm going to have to say it, the Medway vernacular, of what kind of cock-ups caused Britain and the North to be on the brink of war?
Well, what you have to understand is that that Britain at the beginning of the war was in a kind of a tricky position. It was the world's hyperpower. The Confederacy has a lot of friends in Britain. I mean, a lot of friends. You know, the vast majority of the House of Commons, for instance, were very pro-Confederate. It's not because they loved slavery. They all kind of just thought it was one of these vestigial relics that would eventually disappear. But the fact is that the cotton is the blood of the economy. And again, there's also a romantic attachment. You know, all these Confederate plantationers were kind of misconceived as, you know, kind of these sort of, you know, aristocrats just like us, you know, big landowners, you know, good chaps all around. So the Confederacy wanted to lure Britain into declaring for the South against the North in a kind of an Anglo-Confederate alliance, you know, and that would mean that the Royal Navy, for instance, would attack the U.S. Navy, and British soldiers could invade the North from Canada. I mean, there's it would have been a great move if you could pull it off. So the Confederacy's job is to pull Britain in. Britain is not a big fan of the North. It thinks they're a bunch of, you know, tariff-obsessed Bulgarians like Lincoln, who's very anti-British. So there's not a lot of friends there, and they're also big economic competitors as well. But at the same time, they're not stupid, and they don't want to be lured into somebody else's war. So what the British do is that they, at the beginning of the war, I think it's Russell who says, there's this argument and there's that argument for and against going in, but for God's sake, let's keep out of it. So what Britain wanted to do was basically wait and see, like see who was winning and then kind of, you know, support that side. You know, it's just, you know, power politics, the usual stuff.
The thing we normally do.
Yeah, France did exactly the same. It's sort of sensible, you know, it's a sensible diplomatic move. Now, of course, that annoys both the Confederates and it annoys both the Union because, while they're not recognizing the Confederacy as an independent state, they're not doing that either. And for the Confederacy, they were disappointed, heavily disappointed that the Brits hadn't come in for them, hadn't swooped in to save them. So basically what you have is, a kind of a tense situation in 1861 between Britain and the Union. There's a lot of people agitating for Britain to declare war against the Union. And what it needs is a spark. And that spark is presented by, Captain Charles Wilkes, who's a U.S. Navy captain, really accomplished sailor, you know, like Captain Bligh. I mean, this guy sort of explored the deepest Pacific before the war and did an incredible job of it. But he was also a martinet who had a habit of court-martialing junior officers whenever they disagreed with him. Anyway, he comes in sailing a frigate, I think, and this is in November, I think, 1861. And he comes across a British mail packet carrying two Southern diplomats called Mason and Slidell, who are coming to Britain on a British ship in order to try and discuss this alliance. He says he declares them contraband of war, and he takes them prisoner, takes them off the ship, you see, and runs off. This creates a colossal firestorm in Britain because what you have is this impertinent Wilkes fellow stopping and boarding a free British ship, commercial ship, and then kidnapping and shanghaiing two diplomats from a nation that Britain wasn't at war with. So this is, it's called the Trent affair, because the ship was called the RMS Trent. And the two sides, I mean, in Britain, there's like Confederate flags everywhere. The newspapers are hammering away at the Union saying, we need to go to war now. It gets all a bit jingo-y, the whole thing. Lord Palmerston, from that quote that you mentioned earlier, is kind of getting a bit gunboat on this. getting very excited at this blow against, you know, a more proper, and it's Russell along who kind of sides with Prince Albert, who's ailing at the time, to sort of calm things down. And they intervene with this, and they come to an agreement that, you know, look, they talk to Lincoln privately, and they say, look, just give back the two diplomats and kind of make an apology, and we can make this go away. Because nobody really wants war. Lincoln, to his great credit, says, okay, fine. And he orders the release of the prisoners. He doesn't make an apology, though. He doesn't go that far. But, you know, Russell decides that he'll overlook it. And so peace is restored. It's one of these, it's a great crisis. A great, but during it, the Confederates are over the moon because this is it. This is the great spark that will push Britain into war against the Union. This is what they've been waiting for. They're you know, happy as Larry about it. But the Union manages, as I mentioned, to sort of negotiate its way out of it. But what it shows is that, you know, to Confederates and Union alike, that Britain has to be handled very, very carefully, and that it can swing either way quite violently. And that circumscribes the espionage war going on in Britain at that time between the Union and the South. They have to, you know, they have to sort of curtail their activities a little bit because they don't want to start, you know, angering their hosts, as they say.
Absolutely. And the Confederate agents aren't just smuggling and blockade running, but they're also commissioning warship construction, aren't they?
Yes, the Confederates had a three-phase plan. The first was to build a swarm of blockade runners. These were small, light, flighty ships whose only job was to sneak in and out of southern ports, you know, carrying, well, you know, they would say cargo, the Union would say contraband, of cotton going out, and they would stop off at Nassau and then transship to a bigger ship going to Liverpool, and in return bringing back in the munitions, arms, all sorts of stuff coming back in, even, you know, drugs, you know, like laudanum for operations in ether and so on for the new surgery that was going on in the battlefield. So that is designed to poke holes and keep the blockade and keep the South alive. Stage two was to build commerce raiders, and these would later become the famous CSS Florida and Alabama and Shenandoah. But focusing on the Florida and Alabama first, their job was to go out there and just sink as many Union merchant vessels as possible. You know, sink their cargo. And the plan there was for, you know, to provoke Northern businessmen into pushing Lincoln into seeking an armistice with the South, a kind of a ceasefire. That's what the South wanted. The South didn't have to win the war. It just had not to lose it. And Lincoln eventually, well, this was the plan. And of course, Lincoln eventually would have to seek a kind of a, you know, a ceasefire. And then they would spend the next 5 years negotiating the border and slavery and all this kind of stuff. And then the third stage was that if that didn't work, then they would send out two of the most modern warships of the time. These were ironclads. This was a great time of the transition from wooden sail ships to iron steamships. And these things were, you know, they were a really advanced weapons platform. They had, you know, rotating turrets, gun turrets. They had thick armor. And, you know, most impressively, they had this gigantic ram at the front of them underneath the prow. And their job was to just go out there and ram U.S. Navy warships. I mean, basically drown them at sea. And that would finally break the Union once they started really losing, you know, their ships. That would be the end of the blockade. The South would be free to import and export, and the war could continue. So that was the essential plan here.
Obviously, that takes quite a lot of resources, and it's not something you can secretly build. You know, you can't secretly have warships being constructed. And the Union, although I'm sure the Confederacy would preferred that the Union were a bit daft and not really involved. They were involved, and they have their own agents in England. How do they try to stop this building program, and how successful are they? Because obviously Britain are trying to stay neutral, and building warships for any side in a war is frowned upon, and the British government were keen not to get involved. So what were the Union spies trying to do to stop it, and how were they trying to convince the British authorities that this was going on and get them to stop it?
Well, the essential problem facing the Union in Britain was that, for the most part, until the ironclad rams came about, but that was significantly later in the war, was that these weren't warships. These were, well, you know, freighters, cargo ships. They were, you know, little pleasure yachts. I mean, you could, sailing ships. You could disguise commerce raiders like the Alabama and the Florida and the blockade runners as just regular civilian ships. And that was part of the cleverness of the plan that James Bullock, the Confederate agent, came up with, and that he was circumscribed by something called the Foreign Enlistment Act, which had been passed half a century earlier and that everyone had pretty much forgotten about. It had never been used in court. It had never been tried at all. And it had originally been passed around the time of the Napoleonic Wars, just after the Napoleonic Wars, to prevent British volunteers heading off to, you know, join up with rebellions in South America, basically mercenaries. What everyone had forgotten was, is that it also had a naval section. And that naval section was very, very clear on that you are not allowed to build, commission, purchase, acquire in any way, or equip, or fit out as a warship in Britain, in British waters, that was going to be used in a war in which Britain was not involved, or against a power that Britain was friendly with. And Britain was friendly technically with both sides. That is a huge obstacle to building a navy, as you can perhaps gather. And that's why Bullock read the legislation, he read the law very, very carefully, and he found a loophole in it. And that was, is that it didn't say that you couldn't build a civilian ship that was later turned into a warship in, say, neutral waters, international waters. So what he would do was that he would disguise these ships like the Alabama and the Florida, and he would, civilian ships, and there wouldn't be any armaments aboard, nothing. I mean, they were completely, you know, whistle clean. And, he would outfit them for long naval voyages, as what you would do if you were a merchant. And the job, what he could do was he would also purchase an old tender, you know, an old freighter that nobody would notice in, say, London or Glasgow or somewhere. And he would fill it with the cannons, the armaments, all that kind of stuff, which you could buy legally. It's weird. You could buy the arms. You just couldn't put them on a ship. And so then the two ships would then rendezvous somewhere way out in the Atlantic, well away from prying eyes, and there the armaments and so forth would be transferred over to the civilian ship, which was always hidden under a different name. And then Confederate officers and men would come aboard, and they would commission that ship into the Confederate Navy, and it would sort of emerge from the chrysalis as this beautiful brand new battleship or warship that nobody had known about. See, that's the game. So what the Union has to do. And the Union effort was run by a man called Thomas Dudley. And he was this sort of modest, you know, he was the son of a sort of a modest Quaker farmer, very, very different from Bullock. Bullock was this dexterous, cat-like, sort of feline, well, fox-like of the title. He had a, you know, quite ironic, worldly, cynical, that kind of thing. Whereas Dudley lacked any discernible sense of humor whatsoever. But he was a lion. I mean, he was completely rigid. He was he was an abolitionist, a strict abolitionist from decades earlier. I mean, he used to go down south disguised as a southern slave trader and buy slaves and bring them back up north, which was, you know, a very dangerous occupation. You know, it's very easy to end up on the side of a road somewhere and nobody finds out about it, you know, if you get caught. And he had gone over to Liverpool just by happenstance as the consul, you know, low diplomatic position. It was just supposed to be there for a year. He pulled some strings for Lincoln and for the election. You know, he's a sort of stout Republican, and he just happened to be there, and he loathes Bullock. I mean, he just thinks he's the scum of the earth, and he thinks the Confederacy is the scum of the earth, and that he will uproot them and destroy them, whatever it takes, whatever it costs. And he knows that Bullock is evading the law. He knows what he's doing, but he can't prove it. This is still a legal system. You can't just, Dudley cannot just point a finger at Bullock and go to the authorities and say, that guy is breaking the law. A, because he's not breaking the law. He's keeping strictly to the law. And B, you have to persuade, the officials to act on this. It's not just, you have to collect a huge amount of evidence. You have to put spies into their shipyards, all of whom are working hand in glove with Bullock. They're all in this sort of cone of silence. So what Dudley does is he has to acquire all of these affidavits and, as I said, detectives and spies, and he has to search around. And again, he's in Liverpool, which is a very anti-union city. So he's in a real hostile ground. Now, you have to remember that Liverpool at the time was a heavily pro-Confederate city. When Bullock first showed up in Liverpool back in 1861, he said there was more Confederate bunting there, more flags in the streets celebrating the South than there were actually in the capital of the South, of Richmond. So it was friendly territory to him. I mean, Bullock could count on all the shipyards, all the shipyard owners, all of the politicians, all of the merchants, most of the sailors, to kind of be on his side. This was going to be easy, he thought, building all these ships. And it was for a while until he ran into Thomas Dudley, the Union consul. And Dudley initially makes mistakes. I mean, a lot of mistakes. He's being run ragged by Bullock. Bullock is a kind of a magician. I mean, he can see round corners. He can predict what Dudley's going to do at any given time and take evasive action. The guy is just this sort of Penn and Teller of spies. And Dudley can't work it out. Like, he doesn't understand how he's constantly being outplayed. And so he makes mistake after mistake, but he recruits. Eventually he wises up a bit. And that's part of the arc of his character in the book. And that Dudley, he recruits an Irish detective called Maguire, who used to be on the police force. And now he's a private investigator. Tailing people for their divorces and so on. But Maguire is the guy who knows his way around Liverpool. He knows the ins and outs. He knows the taverns. He knows how the place works. And remember, Dudley at the time is this nice local sort of conveyancing solicitor type from New Jersey. He doesn't know anything. So Maguire kind of serves as his sort of Virgil, guiding Dante down through the inferno. And, over time, it takes a long time, and he makes bad errors and he messes up, and Bullock, evades his snares all the time, constantly. But eventually Dudley manages to bag Bullock and sort of nail him to the wall. It's a kind of a mixed metaphor there, but he eventually manages to persuade the British to start investigating Bullock's so-called legal commissioning of this navy, and that's when they really start getting into this cat and mouse, this cat versus cat scenario where they're both trying to outwit and outfox each other. Something there slightly. I know that went off a little bit.
No, that was fine. I think
okay.
Did you have any other comments, Chris, or shall I move to the next question?
No, you go for it.
Okay. Great. And you've mentioned earlier in our discussion the Florida and the Alabama. Could you tell us a little bit more about how successful they were in these missions?
Yeah, they were quite successful. I mean, they were feared on the open sea. They were like the U-boats, off the coast of America in early 1942 during Operation. I mean, they were feared. They were sinking freighters and taking cargoes and all this kind of stuff. Almost without any problem at all. They were both captained by, you know, first-rate captains. They had very good crews. They knew, these were people who knew their business. But there's a fatal flaw in them. And it's the same with, say, the U-boats. You can't beat someone. You can't beat a country like the Union, by just taking their stuff. they were taking things like molasses and Chinese tea and, at one point, fireworks for some reason. And, things like that, foods and all this kind of stuff. The problem is that these are pantry goods. I mean, they're useful if you want to bring them back to the South and give them out to your people and so on. But there's no way the Union is going to surrender just because they've just lost a few hundred gallons of molasses. It's not going to happen. This is the major misconception that they have. So if Bullock had succeeded in building, 12 of these things, and they had been ranging far and wide, all over the place and just rampaging through the Union merchant fleets, then that probably would have put a lot more pressure on Union, on Lincoln, and that would have fulfilled the plan. But as it was with just two, they just simply didn't have the numbers to do what they were supposed to do. And the reason why they only had two was because Dudley in Liverpool was making damn sure that he was frustrating Bullock at every turn by then. So that's what his main job was. He couldn't stop everything, but he could stop a lot of it. And that was the key to his success.
I specialize in First World War German commerce traders. And the German Navy had several massive drawbacks with them. Did the Alabama suffer as well from having to constantly source ammunition and then worry about battle damage? Because like a German cruiser like the Emden, if she took any damage, there was no way for her to get repaired. If she finished up her ammunition, that was it. She couldn't get any more. Did the Alabama and the Florida have a similar sort of problem?
That's a good question. No, not really. One reason being is that they didn't really, 98% of the time, they didn't tangle with warships that could actually damage them. they took merchant vessels who weren't going to put up much of a fight. So they didn't really incur much damage. Now you get sea damage, you get broken masts and you get broken down engines and all this kind of stuff, from being at sea for a very long time. But there were any number of friendly ports they could go into. One of the biggest for them, the major ones, was Nassau, which was British owned, but it was it was a very friendly port for the South. It was almost like Switzerland in World War II. It was this kind of this hotbed of espionage and dubious dealings and that kind of thing. So they could pull in there and get things repaired without too much of a problem. But it didn't really happen that often. They weren't fighting very much.
No, so it's always the aim to avoid the enemy warships. But every now and then you accidentally bumble into one. So I guess they were quite lucky.
The Alabama I can't remember which one. They did actually. It was quite embarrassing for the Union. I think they managed to take a ship full of U.S. Marines who just instantly surrendered. But again, these are pinpricks. I mean, compared to the giant land war that was going on, and that this was part of that bigger scheme. You just couldn't topple the Union by taking some guys prisoner or, even sinking a small, schooner or, armed schooner. It's not going to make that much difference to the war effort.
Okay. But we have someone called Clarence Yong who turns up. And he has the potential to have a huge effect on the situation, doesn't he?
Yeah, the Clarence Yong's interesting because I won't say too much about it, but the reason why Bullock seemed to have this magical ability to know what Dudley was going to do is because he knew what Dudley was going to do. And the reason he knew that was that he had a, again, to use a bit of an anachronism, a mole or an agent, a friend in the Foreign Office in London. And this friend would he was in charge of the American desk at the and so he saw all the correspondence between between Dudley's contacts at the US Embassy in London and the Foreign Office. And so he, whenever there was a raid that was about to happen or anything like that, there was going to be a customs inspection of this so-called merchant ship in Liverpool, you know, he would be able to tip off Bullock, and Bullock would be able to get the ship out, you know, just manage to clean up the crime scene, so to speak, before anyone happened across it. Dudley, unbeknownst to Bullock, also has a man inside. Though again, it was just an act, and he was a walk-in. And it was a guy called Clarence Young, who's this young fellow that Bullock had recruited and trusted. He was essentially his private secretary. And you know, he had seen all the correspondence that Bullock had made, the secret stuff that he was making deals with the shipyards, and it was well known that he was recruiting British subjects into the Confederate Navy, which again really was breaking the law. And he was arranging for armaments to be put on board the Florida and the Alabama and so forth when they were out in international waters. So it was a known conspiracy. Clarence Young is an awful man, but he's a bit pitiable at the same time. He was put aboard the Alabama's the Purser, you know, just to keep an eye on the money. And of course, he and the captain hate each other. Young is a bit of a spoiled brat, gets drunk all the time, which really didn't go well with Captain Raphael Seams of the Alabama, who had a no-nonsense attitude towards, he had a robust views on law and order at sea, let's put it that way. And, you know, he just dumps Clarence Young in Jamaica. He just leaves him behind one day. He just says, I've had enough. Drums him off the ship. Young being quite enterprising, manages to kind of hook up with a local woman, and together they kind of get married. And he didn't really bother telling her that there was already a Mrs. Young, but she was in the South somewhere. So there were two Mrs. Youngs around. And they go back to Liverpool, and he's very, very angry, and he blames Bullock for putting him in this mess. And so he dumps the second Mrs. Young in Liverpool, and it wasn't very, very bland. And he tries to sneak aboard a ship going back to America, you see. But he runs out of money. So what he does is he says, you know what? I hate Bullock, and I hate this guy. So I'm going to go to the guy who paid me for information at the U.S. Embassy. He walks into the American Embassy and says, you know, guys, have I got a secret for you? And this is the mother of all secrets. And it's in one of these weird historical coincidences that at that exact moment, Dudley arrives from Liverpool carrying a sheaf of papers, tons and tons of sensitive documents, dealing with, all signed by Clarence Young, and dealing with this exact same story. It's just a coincidence. And the reason is that the second Mrs. Young, who aggrieved herself, had gone to Dudley and said, would you like all of these papers that Clarence has left behind? So of course he buys them. Now what happens is that Clarence just blows the gaff. I mean, Clarence Young knows everything about this, about what Bullock has been doing. And so, he's the key. So at that point, Dudley starts putting together the biggest legal case, and he's going, you know, with Clarence Young as the star witness, and they are going to break Bullock once and for all. They're going to expose him. They're going to put him in jail. They're going to put all of his accomplices in jail. This whole thing's going to go down. And it all ends in disaster, but that's a whole different subject, and you'll have to buy the book to find out the exciting conclusion of that episode.
I have to say, respect to the second wife as well. You know, she's dumped in Liverpool. He's trying to go off on, you know, find another ship and all these things. So I just quite like the fact that she's like, oh, you know, he left these papers here. I might be able to sell them. They're interesting.
That's exactly. Yeah. No, she was a woman who knew her own mind on this one. And she knew that this would, how much these things were worth. Dudley, by the way, keeps it a secret from Clarence Young because he doesn't quite trust him. I mean, even Dudley, who was kind of open-eyed about the world in many ways, said, and he rewrites in his diary, you know, I think Young is a bad man. I'm actually quite certain that he's a very bad man, but he is useful. So it's actually an indication that, that Dudley was learning how to play the spy game and how to wise up and how to outwit Bullock. So it's a kind of a great sort of sea change in his thinking. And so he, you know, but he doesn't tell, there's part of this, he doesn't tell Young that he's already got the papers. And so because he wants to make sure that the guy doesn't run away. Right. So he also withholds money from him. He puts him into safe houses and things like that to keep him away from the Confederates, who might very well try and kidnap him and bring him back to the Southport, as they say, questioning. Right? So it's got a very strange episode, the whole thing.
And returning to Bullock, his most audacious move was to try and build ironclad warships. How did that pan out for him?
Well, Bullock at some point has to build these warships as part of stage three of the plan. Now, you cannot hide a ironclad ram and claim that it's a civilian ship. You just simply can't do it. So he has to use a different method to get these out. And so what he comes up with is this sort of Byzantine plan involving, it's quite complicated, but in a nutshell, involving this rather dubious French financier who used to be a shoemaker, but made a fortune in Egypt with his, you know, through his contacts with the Pasha, the Khedive of Egypt. And who was a kind of an amusing character in his own right. And essentially, it's going to, these ships were allegedly commissioned by the Khedive of Egypt for his own Egyptian navy, and they were going to be brokered and paid for by this French financier. And that would leave Bullock out of it. Bullock would, you know, kind of, you know, keep his name out of it. There'd be no papers between him and the shipyard. The shipyard would be selling the ships, so to speak, to the French businessmen who would be selling them on to the Egyptians. So it was all legitimate. You could do that. I mean, Egypt was a friend of Britain. It was a good commission. I mean, at the same time, the Chinese emperor was commissioning a small fleet in Liverpool. It was a fairly, you know, normal transaction. Of course, it sets off Dudley's alarm bells because he knows that there's something going on, but he can't pierce this carapace of silence. It's very, very difficult to break into this. So it's a kind of a complicated story. It's a very interesting one about how Dudley then manages to gather the evidence and then on top of that, persuade the British government to act on this and to shut down this operation once and for all. And so that's the sort of the conclusion of the book. But it's a fantastic story about this whole very questionable a bit of arms dealing here and there. But it that's what hangs Bullock in the end. I mean, not literally, but they're all gentlemen about it. Nobody gets hanged in this. But it essentially ends the operation in many ways.
Originally, I was going to ask what happens to the key players, because it's so interesting. But I think people should go away and read this book, because it is genuinely, it's not often that I pick up a book that I can't put down. And literally for the last 2 weeks, I've been reading this book continually, and it's fantastic. So Alex, would you mind telling us again the title of your book?
The title of the book is The Lion and the Fox, Two Rival Spies and the Secret Plot to Build a Confederate Navy. But it's I wrote it as a quick, easy, kind of thrilling read.
Also, Alex, where else could, if people are interested in your work and what projects you're working on and things you have worked on, where else can they find you on the internet?
I run a small free newsletter on Substack called Spionage, which deals with sort of, you know, old world spying and historical intelligence, you know, stuff that interests me from ancient Assyria up to sort of World War II, the 1950s. And there's also my website, which is www.alexrose.com. And, you know, I put all the stuff about my books there. I have a Twitter as well, which I occasionally deal with. So it's pretty easy to find me.
Thanks ever so much for coming on to the first of this as yet unnamed naval history podcast for History Hack. It's been a really interesting subject to look at, and I know I've said it several times before, but please go and buy the book. It's fantastic. And thanks to Beth as well for coming along.
No, thanks for the invite. And thanks, Alex. That was a really interesting episode.
Our incredible guests give us 45 minutes of their time to join us and talk about their work or their new book. This is just a small taster. As a result, we have launched our very own bookshop on bookshop.org, where you can find our guests' latest books. You can support them and you can support us on History Hack. 10% of every sale via our bookshop supports the podcast and allows us to keep going and bring you more top-of-the-line guests. You can find our bookshop at bookshop.org/shop/History Hack, or search for us in the shop section. Thank you so much for your continued support. We really appreciate our listeners and supporters. So make sure you get down to the bookshop and grab yourselves a new book.